Good morning. I call the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, April 29th at 8:06 a.m. Members present are Representative Holland, Representative Hall, Representative Ruffridge, Co-Chair Rebecca Hemshute, and myself, Co-Chair Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members and staff to please silence their cell phones. And as a reminder, staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Talia Ames, and she will take care of it. Before we get started, I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Sophia Tenney, and helping us from the Juno LIO is Zach Lawhorn. Of course, our super awesome committee aides, Thatcher Brower and Talia Ames. We have three bills on our agenda today. First, we will consider amendments on House Bill 133, Payment of Contracts, co-sponsored by Co-Chair Hemshute. Then we will do HB 47, Generated Obscene Child Sex Abuse Material, sponsored by Representative Vance. We received one amendment for each bill. And lastly, we will hold public testimony on House Bill 184, Aid of Finance Workforce Housing Development. First, we'll start with House Bill 133, Payment of Contracts. Co-Chair Hemshute and Ms. Ella Lubin, please welcome to the committee. Please come to the testifier table and put yourself on the record and provide a quick recap to the bill.
Did we just lose Ella?
Yeah.
So,
because we just switched the numbers, Eddie's.
No, we're fine.
Okay.
All right. So, as a reminder for the committee, this is Rebecca Hemshute, represented for House District 2, and House Bill 133, just as a really quick overview, is setting a standard in statute similar to the standard that we have for private contractors doing business with the state, and this standard would make a 30-day deadline for payment to nonprofits, tribes, and municipalities. So that's the core of the bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the committee before we take up our amendment? Excellent.
Do you want me to move an amendment?
Representative Hall?
I would love to move amendment number one.
And I will object for the purposes of explanation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears. Amendment number one basically removes a section that has been deemed redundant, page 2, line 23 through page 3, line 5. Section 3 of this measure was added into the CS in order to align the language of current statute, which provides prompt payment for private contractors, so the language of the bill. Section 3 amends 36.90.200B, which in the statute's current form is written with language that does not reflect the intent. Subsection B of current statute states that for delayed payments, quote, the state or political subdivision shall pay interest on the unpaid amount of the required payment from the 21st calendar day after the date required for payment, end quote. The error is as follows. Subsection A gives payment deadlines, and subsection B allows interest to begin accruing 21 days after those payment deadlines, thus creating a strange liminal period between the payment deadline and 21 days after that, at which point interest accrual begins. So Section 3 removes that unintended liminal period by replacing the language with, quote, the state or political subdivision shall pay interest on the unpaid amount of the required payment from the day payment is due, end quote. Section 2 amends subsection A, which is not necessary to do. Therefore, this amendment removes Section 2 altogether, and it also updates the title of the bill by removing, quote, the deadline for payments and, end quote.
Can we take an Eddie's, please?
Eddies. Good morning. We are back on the record. Representative Hall, I think you went a little fast for some of us there. Very clear and well stated, but could you
Yes.
Give us a summary about which section we're removing.
Yes. We would. So the amendment is to remove Section 2, starting on page 2, line 23, through page 3, line 5. And the reason for the removal is because it is redundant to the overall intent of the bill.
Thank you. I'd also like to recognize that Representative Brooks has joined us at 8:11 or so. Would we like to have a deeper discussion about this change? Representative Holland?
Thank you. Through the chair, if it's quick and simple, I'm just wondering if Section 2 is redundant, could you point me to where the intent of this section is already being covered?
Representative Hemshue?
Chair Mears, it may be helpful to have my staff, Ella Lubin, explain what we're trying to do here, because this was done with stakeholders, and it's resolving a longstanding problem that we thought we fixed with our CS, only to find that we made it worse. So this is the cleanup language they were actually looking for the first time around. So would it be okay if Ms. Lubin?
Please, Ms. Lubin, please put yourself on the record.
For the record, Ella Lubin, staff to Representative Hemshue. I'm sorry, Representative, through the chair, Representative Holland, if you can repeat your question.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, just clarification, I understand that Section 2 will be removed because it's redundant, and I just was looking for clarification of where is the other language that now controls or accomplishes what is intended and that this was redundant to.
Excuse me. For the record, Ella Lubin. Yes, through the chair, Representative Holland, current statute 3690-200 already establishes prompt payment deadlines for private contractors of public works and public construction projects.
Oh, Section 3.
Yes, thank you. And Section 2 touches on subsection A of that current statute, which provides for those deadlines. Section 3 of the CS touches on subsection B of current statute, which, as Representative Hall very rapidly described, was written with a discrepancy that neither the stakeholders nor, I believe, the creators of the bill, it does not reflect the intent. It creates this strange liminal period through language that we fixed in our CS for nonprofits, tribes, and municipalities, and now Section 3 fixes that discrepancy for private contractors as well, and Section 2 needed not to be altered. Sorry, that was a long-winded way, and happy to answer any other questions if that doesn't answer it.
I'm good enough. Thank you.
Thank you. I will remove my objection. Are there any further objections to adoption of this amendment? Amendment 1 passes. Thank you, Ms. Lubin. So is there any further discussion on House Bill 133 before we take action to move it? Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshue. With that, Representative Hall, we're ready for a motion.
Co-Chair Mears, I move HB 133, Work Order 34-LS0114/H, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, House Bill 133, Work Order 34-LS0114/H, as amended, moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the bill. We're back on the record with House Community and Regional Affairs, and now we are on to House Bill 47, Generated Obscene Child Sex Abuse Material, from Representative Vance. Mr. Bob Ballinger, please come put yourself on the record and give the committee a short recap of the bill.
Good Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Ballinger from Representative Vance's office. And the bill really essentially does three things. One is it expands current child sexual abuse material statutes for the possession and distribution to include the likeness of an actual known child. So somebody generates material that is a child that is identifiable as a known child, then they'd be prosecuted or could be prosecuted under current child sexual abuse material statutes. And then it creates a new statute that even if the child can't be identified, but it would meet the definition of child sexual abuse material and also be seen as obscene, which most would do that. Then it meets that standard. Then it creates a new crime of generated child sexual abuse material. And the third thing the bill does is bring that new statute into conformity with child sexual abuse material in other places in the code. So things like a licensed bus driver is one of the things, the reason why the title, that's included in the title, and it is now listed as a sexual crime. You know, it removes it out of things like harassment, if it's a crime of harassment, or if it's a crime of that is being prosecuted under child sexual abuse material, then it's not harassment. So everything else is conforming language.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions before we get to amendments? No. Mr. Ballinger, why don't you still stay here while we discuss the amendment. Representative Prox?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number one.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
So can we take an Addies, please?
Mm-hmm. Addies. Thank you. We are now back on the record in House Community and Regional Affairs. Representative Prox, could you please explain this very short title amendment?
Yes. The bill itself doesn't address anything that has to do with the powers of district judges and magistrates. So this is just to clean that up and make it simpler to understand. And Mr. Ballinger is the bill sponsor staff, and he might be able to add something in addition to that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ballinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Ballinger, Representative Vance's staff. You hit the nail on the head. Ms. Mead from the judiciary came to me and said, hey, I noticed that your bill doesn't have anything to do with magistrates, and this is the title. And so I called to legal and brought that to the attention, and the legal said, you're right, and probably needs to be taken out. So that's where the amendment came from.
Thank you, and I assume this amendment is supported by Representative Vance's office.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Is there further discussion on the amendment? I will remove my objection. Any further objection? Excellent. So amendment one passes. Is there any further discussion on the bill from the committee? I just have one thing. I mean, we were talking earlier this session with Representative Rauscher about his AI task force bill, and it would have been nice to see some more movement on that as we're getting into this. It's AI is a whole new depth of things that state legislators and all sorts of folks need to get into. So in some ways it feels a little cart before the horse, but also something to not wait to address. So it's timing issues, but we'll get there. So hopefully we're not going to have to come back and address things as we learn more about regulating AI, but I imagine there's going to be more discussion on AI and its impacts on many different things as we move forward. So with that, I am looking for a motion. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears. I move House Bill 47, Work Order 34-LS0334/N, as amended for committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Any objections? Seeing no objection, House Bill 47, Work Order 34-LS0334/N, as amended, moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll now take a brief at ease to sign the bill paperwork. Good morning. We are back on the record with House Community and Regional Affairs. Our last bill on the agenda this morning is House Bill 184, Aid of Finance Workforce Housing Development, for discussion and public testimony. Representative Story and staff, Ms. Honor Miller Austin, please come to the committee table and put yourself on your record and provide a brief recap of the bill.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears, Co-Chair Himshut, and members of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. For the record, I am Representative Andy Story, proudly serving House District 3, which is the northern Mendenhall Valley here in Juneau, Haynes, Cluckwan, Gustavus, and Skagway. As we discussed in our first hearing of this bill on last Thursday, April 24th, Alaska is facing a housing crisis and a shortage in building of multifamily housing constructions of five dwellings or more. What is needed is typically higher density rental housing units for many residents who make up a large part of our workforce. Businesses, as you know, are reporting having difficulty finding personnel because they cannot get housing, so they have turned down jobs in our state, and residents report lack of housing as a stress and a factor in making a decision to leave or stay in Alaska. This lack of housing, affordable housing, is hindering the growth of our economy. It is a necessity that more housing is built in Alaska. The bill before you allows the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, AIDA, to provide loans for housing construction containing five or more dwelling units that cost the occupant less than 30% of their income of those making 120% of the area mean income as determined by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD. It was asked in the first hearing how the numbers in Section 5 of the sectional analysis defining workforce housing was determined. The 30% is derived from HUD's understanding of what constitutes affordable, and that rent should make up no more than 30% of a household's income. The point that Ref Ruffridge made about this not being affordable for the average person is mostly accurate. In response to the committee's questions, a chart was sent to the committee, I believe you have it, from AHFC with corresponding rent caps to the committee, which you should have before you so we can get an idea of what affordable is according to that definition. If we go along, if the committee wants to amend those numbers to something that they feel is more accessible to a wider income group, I am open, and the sponsor of the companion bill in the Senate is also agreeable. The focus of this bill is workforce housing for individuals and families, and it is typically rental units or rental condos. And the problem, the housing problem in Alaska, it's primarily that new builds of multifamily housing are just not happening. I believe a couple of articles were handed out to give us more of a snapshot of that problem. And affordability is a problem. And when we look at what will pencil out, what ends up with happening with developers is they're ending up doing higher single-family homes. And we have heard a couple examples in our first hearing about how what intended to be affordable homes did not become affordable homes. AIDA stated that they already have had discussions about the need for funding of multi-unit housing projects with some municipalities. The authority is well situated to provide these loans through their loan participation programs. AIDA says that they already have the ability to finance workforce housing, but they haven't done so since the 80s. This bill specifies loans for workforce housing in statute and would contribute to AIDA's goal of developing more industry in Alaska by meeting industry's housing needs for a healthy workforce. If we do not have housing for our workers, our economy, our workforce, it's already suffering. So it's really important to incentivize the construction of these much-needed developments. I believe that investment in AIDA, state resources, is one investment that Alaskans would really support ADA being more involved with. I have two invited testifiers today, Brian Holst, the Executive Director with the Juneau Economic Development Council, and Michelle Brown, Program Manager for Housing Alaskans. And online, we have Brandon Brifninski, Deputy Director for Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, and Stacey Barnes, Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, so they can answer questions about this bill also. So thank you very much for hearing the bill today.
Thank you very much. And with our invited testimony available, I think we'll go there before we have discussion within the committee. Mr. Holst, since you're in the room here this morning. Invited. Good morning. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Well, good morning. Thank you. Representative Mayors, Representative Himshute, as co-chairs and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 184. My name is Brian Holst. I'm the Executive Director of the Juneau Economic Development Council. Alaska's persistent shortage of affordable workforce housing is a major barrier to economic growth and community stability. HB 184 addresses this by expanding the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority's powers to directly support the financing and development of workforce housing projects containing five or more units. Why is HB 184 needed? Alaska's housing crisis is well documented. In Juneau, the rental vacancy rate is just 4%, well below the 5-8% threshold for a healthy market, indicating that demand far outpaces supply. And this is not unique to Juneau. Across the state, construction of new housing has not kept up with demand, especially for multifamily rental units that serve working families. High development costs, often more than double those in the lower 48, mean that many workforce housing projects simply do not pencil out without additional financing tools. This shortage is contributing to Alaska's ongoing net out-migration and workforce challenges. For 12 consecutive years, more people have left Alaska than have moved in. Critically, the state's working age population, those 18 to 64, has dropped by 34,000 people since 2013. Anchorage, our largest city, has lost 19,000 working age residents in that same time. And these losses are not just about people leaving. Potential new arrivals are also staying away, often because they cannot find suitable housing. At the same time, Alaska employers are increasingly forced to rely on non-resident workers. In 2023, non-residents made up 22.5% of Alaska's workforce, the highest percent in 25 years. We currently have over 92,000 non-resident workers, an all-time high. This trend is especially pronounced in industries like construction, where the number of non-resident workers recently jumped 24% in a single year, but also in industries like mining and oil and gas. Those are the industries that pay the highest wages in our state. Many of these workers would consider relocating to Alaska if affordable housing were available. So how does HB 184 help? HB 184 updates ADA's statutory purpose and powers, allowing the authority to use its established financing tools, tools like loans, loan guarantees, bonds, developing finance, to support the construction of new workforce housing facilities. It also provides a clear definition of workforce housing, ensuring projects serve households earning up to 120% of area median income. These tools enable ADA to bridge financing gaps, reduce project risk, and could make workforce housing projects more likely to be built, especially given Alaska's high construction costs, remote locations, and limited private sector appetite for such projects. ADA's independence, financial expertise, and ability to partner with private lenders and developers make it well positioned to address the financing gaps that have stalled many workforce housing projects. By providing flexible, lower cost capital and sharing risk, ADA could help projects pencil out and ensure more housing gets built for Alaskans. In conclusion, HB 184 is a practical, targeted solution to Alaska's workforce housing crisis. By empowering ADA to invest in workforce housing, the legislature can help reverse net migration losses, reduce reliance on non-resident labor, and make it possible for more workers to call Alaska home. Increasing the supply of affordable housing in Alaska is essential to keeping our community strong and our economy growing. I encourage your support for HB 184. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ruffridge?
Well, thank you, Chair. I appreciate your testimony today. And I think when I look at this bill, I essentially have one question. What is affordable in this case? So I want to pose that question to you. What would affordable housing look like? What is the rent for that place? Is it a rental only, or is it a condo that someone could purchase? And if it's a purchase, how much should that cost?
Through the chair, this bill defines the amendments. The definition of workforce housing in this bill defines it as 120% of median household income. In Alaska, that's about $80,000, $90,000. So it's housing that's accessible to working families in Alaska. And again, as I heard Representative Story mention, apparently that is up for some debate. I think targeted to so that the product is a results in housing for working families is important. And so I think that's the affordability range. What the price will be in each community, I think, is going to be market driven. Of course, I don't think this bill asks to set prices. It just asks to create housing that is accessible to people in that income range. 30% of that income would be the target generally. Not to exceed 30% of your median household income is the standard for housing. Lately, I think we've seen in America that families are forced to pay 35, 40%, but beyond that, it becomes not affordable.
So we did, and potentially, I don't know if, does he have access to this chart that we all got from your email? Yeah.
I'm just coughing right here.
So we asked this question in our last hearing, and we got some really great information back that actually the rent limit at 30% of that 120% of AMI is actually a really big number for a lot of areas around Alaska. And so I'm going to go back to my original question, which was, and I mean, it can be speculative. It doesn't have to be data driven. I guess the question to me is, what is affordable? What is the target that we might be looking for workforce housing? If we're going to define it as this, to me, the numbers that I see on the right hand of this column, I would describe as unaffordable, especially as a person that employs people in the state. This is not an affordable rent for most people. What is affordable? That's sort of my question. And if it's rent we're looking for, is it $1,500 a month? Is it $1,700 a month? And also, what is affordable for, let's say, workforce housing as a purchasable item? Is it $250,000, $300,000? I'm wondering just generally what your thoughts are on that.
Can we moderate that since he's got experience in Juneau and we're all here? Maybe we can just talk about it very specifically to Juneau.
Absolutely. Yep. That's exactly what that question was for. Like, just in your experience, what would you define as affordable?
Yeah, so through the chair, what I see here, I appreciate seeing this information about the rent limit at 30%, and that would be at the proposed maximum highest amount. So yes, that it is only affordable if you're earning 120% of median income. These are not rents that if this rent here in Juneau, which is $3,000, that's not affordable to the most working people. So I think there's two things that come to mind here. One is this number, this is the maximum that would be allowable, and I don't think that's the target. I think that's not to exceed. And if you had 80% of AMI, then what you could pay would be much less. The other phenomenon that I think is really important is that we don't have enough housing, period. And so demand continues to push up the rent. And by bringing on additional supply of housing, the effect will be more demand and I think lower rental prices for everyone in the market. It is not, and part of the reason that rents are high in the first place is not only is it that there is high demand for the few homes that are, few housing rental units that are available, or housing units that are available, it's also the really, really high cost of developing, because there's a high amount of risk. And I think what this option, by enabling ADA to participate, is you're de-risking the process and you're reducing, and that de-risking, and if you're a private developer, risk costs money. And if you can reduce risk and lower costs, you could achieve two things. Perhaps bring more units into the market that cost less, so that you can get a return at a lower rent, and then also bring competition to the market so that you can have more availability of housing, and then those people that are providing housing will lower the price to meet the market demand. So I think there are some other factors here that will come into play in the free market if supply is increased and if the supply of new housing costs less in the future to build.
I've got a follow-up on that. So have you identified for Juno a gap either in available units, either in a certain bracket for rent or in a certain bracket for home purchasing?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. When we look at the housing problem in Juno, we identify that there are needs for housing in all income levels. We see that there's particularly a stronger need for housing for workforce housing, because we're seeing people turned away. It's really hard to judge what that demand is. But we're seeing we have more jobs in Juneau than we have people to take those jobs. We talked about 22.5% of the non-resident workforce in the state. All right, in Juneau, it's about 30% are non-residents. We have two producing mines, six of the state, of the large producing mines in Alaska. Two of them are in Juneau. Excellent, high-paying wages. We recently did a survey of those workers at those mines, and the number one reason that they choose to not live in Alaska is the high cost of housing. So it's a little bit difficult for us to put our finger on exactly what price level we need, but the price level that we're at is too high, and there's not enough supply. And the cost is not, people are choosing to fly back home to Idaho or Montana for a lower price of housing. Again, that's the number one issue. They identify deficiencies in education. They identify some other issues that they're not satisfied with Alaska. But housing, cost of living, is the number one reason our miners choose, that our non-residents choose to not live in Alaska.
Would it be fair to say there seems to be more demand for like a $2,000 a month rather than $3,000 a month?
Yes, I would. And certainly the jobs that our economy is creating are, we're creating more, well, we have a lot of mining jobs, and it's been great to see them grow. We're creating more service jobs. Those service jobs don't pay nearly as well. They don't, on this, your 120% AMI, yeah, I think you would find most service workers are closer to the 80% or less AMI. And so they would need, just by the simple rules of thumb of 30%, they would need housing that's $1,500 a month, $1,200 a month, if it were possible for an apartment. That's probably unrealistic, and you see those are very hard to find in our community.
Thank you. Representative Ruffridge?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Chair Mears. I guess one final question for me is, what is the cost per square foot, if you know that, to build in Juneau?
I don't want to give a number, iPod, but I can get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hall?
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears. I'm curious, in your mind, is there a difference between affordable housing and attainable housing? Is there a difference between the two?
Through the chair, if I'm availability, when you say attainable, or do you mean availability, if I may ask?
I guess through the chair, in the past, my understanding has been affordable housing is more often considered low-income housing, and attainable housing is kind of like the middle, like the missing middle kind of piece of it. That might be the wrong vernacular to use, but are there different, when it comes to the 120% AMI, are there different brackets, I guess, under, like, below the 120% AMI?
Through the chair. Again, when we've looked at housing, we see that there are needs throughout, and there's such a lack of housing in general, we, in our community, to meet the demand, that we need housing at all levels. It is clear that what's driving people from, it's causing people to make the choice to not live in our community is the relatively high cost, but that affects you at all levels. If you're a two-income family, it doesn't seem reasonable to pay $2,500 for a 1,200 square foot home. If you're a one-income person, you know, $2,500 isn't even an option for you. So I don't have a we've tried to make the effort to identify how many units at each level, but none of us are very confident that we have a good handle on what that really means. We just know we don't have enough housing, and it's not because of its affordability across the board.
Okay. Thank you.
And some of it's affordability, right? So, you know, I'm in this situation. My youngest is about to graduate from high school, and, you know, like, where are we going to be with a house that we raised kids in, and what's next? And so when units are tight, when folks are needing to change the size of their housing, it's less likely to happen when markets are high and there's less availability of units. Is that a factor for housing shortages?
Yes, and I think what we're talking about here is what I understand this A to bill look for is market products. So bringing on more, allowing ADA to invest in projects that will produce market housing, not subsidized housing, but housing that is privately available on the market that will be affordable. If you're a builder and you can build a project, there is very strong demand for housing at every level, unfortunately, which is why we see a lot of our housing production that's more expensive than perhaps we'd like. But there is demand. If there was the ability to produce the housing at lower cost, there is demand at lower rental rates as well. High demand, easily documentable.
Thank you. And I think we're getting into that definition there. Affordable, we tend to think of folks that need support to get there. And it's that next bracket of folks. We're getting in on some terminology here. Representative Hemshute, and then Representative Holland.
Thanks. Mine is more of just a comment. I wanted to point out, in Petersburg, I know it took almost a year to fill a really good professional position in town. I think it was the fire chief or director of EMS or something, and I think they had two different candidates come to town interested in the position, but then there was no housing. And so I think those are the people we're trying to target with this. But I wanted to point out, probably state the obvious, we can look at these rents, but then you have to think about in each community, what is the cost of energy? What is the cost of internet? What, you know, all those other costs. So $3,000 in my town for the apartment is one thing, but once you put the utilities and everything else, you're looking at $3,700 for a three-bedroom. So this chart is really helpful, but if we're trying to make more housing available, we have to always, I think, consider in the question of affordability, what is the local cost of living that you have to add to that. So I don't really have a question. I'm just thinking about what this looks like across the state. So thanks.
Very good point, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. I had a couple things I wanted to ask that I'm hoping you might be able to specifically focus on. The first is, as it relates to Juneau and perhaps more broadly, as I look at the housing constraint issue, I see a lot of challenges, whether it's available land, whether it's available builders, whether it's available banks willing to make the loans, whether it's confidence in our economy. And I wonder, is having another source of money the issue, or do we have some other things we need to look at that would allow a new source of money to actually do what we want done? I have a bias, but I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong, that having another bucket of money isn't necessarily a constraint at this point. It's getting folks to want to build in a flat economy to do that. Do you have some thoughts on how this could be aligned in a way that actually is removing the constraint, or maybe it is just that we need more money in this issue?
Through the chair, what I find appealing about this, bringing ADA into this, is it fills a gap, it de-risks, and makes it more affordable to build. There are, if you're a builder in Juneau or and you have a housing project, there are banks that will finance your project. But the cost is going to, you're going to end up producing, as we're seeing often, is housing that is, doesn't meet people's expectations for what they want to pay. Trying to underscape the terminology and not call it affordable, not attainable. So I do believe that part of the solution is additional capital from an organization like a state agency that can share some of the risk. We could be very, this allows ADA to be very creative. Perhaps ADA, I just making up an example if I could, purchases land, holds land, people build on top of the land, community land trust type project, has the ability because it's a because of its structure to hold that for a long time, receive a fairly low return on that asset, which is land, which is something that they would own forever, yet the cost of the units on top are not, the individual purchaser doesn't have to pay for that full cost of the project. They just buy the building, but they don't buy, they don't pay for all of the land. So there are, so that would be a creative way to have an agency like ADA participate in a structure that would, could lower the overall cost of the actual unit. Just an example. I think there are a lot of creative ways where by de-risking a project, you lower the overall cost of the project.
Thank you. Follow-up, if I can.
Representative Holland.
Going a little bit in a different vein, the information you provided early on was referring to the number of non-resident workers that we have. And as I think about the significant growth of non-workers in the mining industry, the oil and gas industry, the medical fields, many of those workers are fairly highly paid workers, some of the best in our state. And I'm wondering if there's alignment between trying to bring in the non-resident workers that currently can afford not to live here because they're flying back and forth buying a ticket that's probably half the cost of a rent. Are we aligning the right housing to bringing in those people and the incomes that they make? Or is there a different gap that we need to try and fill? And it might be, well, I'll kind of leave it there. To me, there's a little bit of a mismatch that the non-resident workers tend to be pretty highly paid. Doctors, engineers, project managers, miners. And I'm not sure that the affordable housing that we're trying to build here fits in with the non-resident workers that we're trying to attract here. Does that make a little bit of sense, the mismatch I'm curious about?
Yes, through the chair. Yeah, I think it was pointed out early in this committee correctly that 30% of AMI at 120%, 30% of that 120% is not low-cost housing. Those are at $3,000. That isn't low rent or low cost. So I think we're talking about people that are the miners, Juneau, who we know well, the highest paying jobs in our community are private sector jobs. All jobs are the mining jobs. And we have hundreds, several hundred of those people that choose to not live in our community. And we recently, with great cooperation, surveyed them. And yes, the number one reason is the cost of housing. They have an option. They can afford to fly in and out, right? But they, when they say, why are they choosing not to? Not that they would never live here, but if the first and most important influence on them, whether or not they could live here, would choose to live here, is the housing cost. So they could afford, they're the, of the group, they are a group that could afford these, some of these prices, but they're not going to pay it because it continues to be relatively unattractive given their other options. I don't think there's a silver bullet here, but I think the ADA option adds the possibility that more housing is brought to the market and that this housing is at or lower than the construction costs that we're experiencing now.
Thank you very much. And then a note on that, in a tour of one of the local mines a couple of years ago, they had to start to shift to attract workers to pay their transportation to come in for their shifts. So that's changing as well, that there's not enough local folks or, you know, folks willing to pay that transportation on their own dime. So that's a shift that changes those economics as well.
Can I follow up on that just briefly? I think what you're raising is a really important point, because I see the opportunity with ADA involved in this, in developing some more public-private partnership-type housing strategies. And what you just related about the fact that the mining companies are having to invest in this problem with money, and ADA's track record of being a good public-private partnership entity, to me, creates a really interesting opportunity to look at exploring how to create these creative spaces that leverage some of the public assets that we have, potentially land, some of the private assets and costs, like the costs that these employers are having to put in to subsidize this, and the community's need to do something new and creative that I think goes beyond just simply another bucket of money, which was my earlier question, that I think there's more to this and more to the opportunity.
And we do have additional public testimony coming, or invited testimony coming up from Michelle Brown, who is the program director for Housing Alaskans Public-Private Partnership. So we'll get further into that. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, my question, I guess, the question in my mind is whether ADA is the correct agency. Alaska Industrial and Export Development Authority, as opposed to AHFC, Alaska Housing Finance Authority. Would we not be better off to focus on Alaska Housing Finance Authority? Does ADA have something that Alaska Housing Finance does not have available to them, and should that problem be corrected? Just the folks' expertise in the area. ADA's getting spread a little thin in my mind, and Alaska Housing has historically been involved in the housing area.
Through the chair, yeah, I'm in no position to comment on AHFC's suitability, but what I see of the strength of ADA is the is that they have a tremendous amount of flexibility in investing in helping to make projects work. So they have a lot of tools available to them, and I think the co-investing is what we would expect from ADA. I don't think we would expect ADA to build a project on their own. We would expect ADA to help projects that are somebody would be interested in the project to bring an array of additional tools and flexibilities to meet that particular need in that particular community. So I'm impressed with their just looking through what they can do. I'm impressed with that, and so I think the ability for them to use their tools is a plus. But I don't have the expertise to comment on the limitations of HFC relative to ADA.
And let's get through our other invited testifier first, but we do have someone from ADA and someone from AHFC online for questions. So with that, thank you very much, Mr. Holst, for joining us today and answering our many questions. It is one of the challenges of being a legislator to gain expertise to at least a certain degree to address certain bills, and having folks that live that is very helpful. So thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Next up, we will move to Michelle Brown, who is here for invited testimony. Ms. Brown, please put yourself on the record with your title and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Can you hear?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. I am Michelle Brown with Housing Alaskan Public-Private Partnership, which is a housing trust that works to accelerate housing development by blending public and private resources. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 184. This bill would make it clear that ADA has the authority to invest in workforce housing development projects and would open the door for ADA to explore an array of innovative financing tools that other states have deployed, tools proven to stimulate housing development. This is not only consistent with ADA's mission to finance for-profit, nonprofit, and community projects for meaningful economic development and job opportunities, it's also necessary to support the workforce needed to breathe life into any of the other major projects that ADA invests in. Alaska's housing shortage is stifling economic growth, community stability, and family well-being. It is always cited in business surveys as one of the leading, if not the top, reason why businesses say they cannot grow. It's also shrinking critical community services because safety officers, healthcare workers, teachers, and so on cannot find housing. But as has been stated, developers are stymied in meeting that demand because the cost of construction and the cost of acquiring capital are now so high they cannot pencil projects that people can afford to pay in rent. Developing a full capital stack now has become increasingly complex and involves multiple layers of funding. It's not just a single loan. Our current efforts are not enough under current market conditions. Other states have demonstrated that state-level financial tools do stimulate the development of affordable housing by providing access to capital on more favorable terms. By clarifying ADA's authority to finance workforce housing, ADA could evaluate and implement finance tools that would directly help Alaska developers. Tools like government-backed loans with lower interest rates, longer-term loan payoffs, mezzanine finance that allows developers to fund projects in stages, spreading out the financial burden over time. And as ADA develops these tools, it can partner with other public-private partnerships, as has been mentioned, that further reduce risk and share resources, which is a proven strategy from other states. In short, financing tools help lower both the upfront and long-term costs of housing development. ADA would have the flexibility to design loan terms in consultation with developers or other state agencies like Alaska Housing Finance that would make a meaningful impact on developers' ability to close the gaps that now exist to create affordable units with what the market can afford to pay. Whether it's low-interest loans, public-private partnerships, or financial risk mitigation strategies, these tools can reduce financial barriers and enable the development of more affordable options. This bill would allow ADA to put some of those tools to work to address our critical housing shortage. And to address a few of the points, if I may, Madam Chair, that were raised in questions, is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. One question was about what is affordable. In a study that we did, and this is statewide, we found the analysis for lower-income households, which would be below 60% of AMI, affordable would be rent up to $1,600. For middle-income households, which is from the 80% to 120% of AMI, the range would be from $1,600 to $2,400, and higher incomes over $120, it would be around $2,400. That is a generic, because it's going to vary community by community, but that's an estimate. And one of the reasons why Housing Alaskans is looking a lot at workforce housing is there are financial tools or subsidies that the federal government offers for lower-income folks, and higher-income folks can generally take care of themselves. It's that middle-income folks, which are kind of the backbone, the most prevalent job classes in our communities, that have no real tools that help drive down the cost for market housing and non-subsidized housing. So that's why we have focused on it. And what we have found is, as one member said, you know, is a new money source enough? And standing on its own, it's a benefit, but it is not enough. But the benefit of this bill in empowering ADA would be to consider leveraging and coordinating funding, because now it takes a developer years and many, many, many applications to acquire a full funding stack. And there's very little coordination among those funding sources to make sure a complete project gets done. And, you know, if ADA were to develop a program with innovative financing tools and bring in the public-private partnership, the employers who are already either building housing or having to subsidize it, philanthropic dollars, and created a more comprehensive system of coordinating the various funding sources in addition to adding money to the pot, it could make a major difference in accelerating housing development. So thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and it's been a very, very productive conversation that I've been listening to, so thank you for that as well.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brown, and thank you for paying attention to the previous discussion and pulling in some of those questions into your testimony. I was wondering about getting back to Representative Hemschutz's question about how utilities play into those ranges of rental prices. Is the utilities on top of those?
Yes. For our study, utilities would be on top of these rental figures.
So, of course, depending on the community, if the utilities are larger, then those ranges would be a little lower, so that your total output for housing would be similar.
Correct.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hemschutz has a follow-up on that, I believe.
No, actually.
Oh, something
question.
New.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know if this question is directed to the right person, but through the chair, one of the issues, I know there was a housing study done in Juneau in the last few years. We have an ongoing conversation in my hometown of Sitka about the impact of short-term rentals on our housing market, only to discover that this Juneau housing study pointed to our aging population, the silver tsunami. And like Co-Chair Mears pointed out, the children leave the home. And what we don't have is anything between the family home and the pioneer home. So the 55-plus communities that you see all over, like in the Southwest, they're everywhere. These, I don't know if they're all gated, but communities that are specifically built with single-level homes with, you know, maximum two bedrooms. Is there work being done in that area? And do you know, Ms. Brown, would this allow ADA to work on that? Or this is specifically workforce housing, so would not address the 55-plus? You know, people in their early 50s are definitely still in the workforce. So, I don't know. Specifically, I think this bill talks about multiple family housing, so it couldn't be a little cluster of individual houses. So could you just comment on that part of our housing market and if this bill supports that gap between the empty nest and needing assisted living?
I can address it in part. You know, what we have right now, I would call it housing gridlock. And that is, you know, in a healthy housing economy, you have people, you know, they start out in rental or low price ownership, and as their income grows, they move up and it frees up the lower cost units for others. And then until they get to the age you're talking about where they want to perhaps downsize and live in a different community, but they cannot afford to do that because the costs are too high, and they're giving up usually a very low interest rate because they've had the house for a long time. So we end up with nobody being able to move, and if we can increase the stock at any of those points, it helps that movement along the entire housing continuum. This bill with focus on workforce is picking a target essentially that is crippling our communities because nobody can afford to bring in workers at that level. So that's why, focusing on workforce is probably our biggest hole right now, but that's not to say we don't have shortages everywhere in that continuum.
Thank you very much. Representative Prox?
Thank you. Through the chair, I'd like to ask the same question about why ADA rather than AHFC. Is there some... Seems to me it should be Alaska Housing versus ADA, which is focused on industrial and commercial. What is ADA able to do that Alaska Housing is not able to do?
I can answer that from where I sit, which is not really, totally well versed in ADA or HFC, and their representatives are online, but ADA has resources right now that could be deployed, and I would think there is no reason why ADA couldn't work with AHSC, and maybe ADA would prefer AHSC, transfer the resources to AHSC, and AHSC, if it chose, could run these programs because they have the housing expertise. ADA has, financing and the money available, but they don't have to run the program. They could choose to join forces with AHSC. They could choose to join forces with, a for-profit entity even, or a non-profit entity. So I think what this bill does is open it up for ADA to invest its resources, whether they do that directly themselves or through partnerships, is a choice that they would make after they evaluate all the conditions.
Thank you, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for being here today. I wanted to follow up on one thing in particular with your experience in the housing market and specifically targeting this workforce demographic, if you will, and income. Do you have any data that or perspective on the need for rental units being built versus condos or ownership units in terms of this gridlock equation? And I think in part I recognize that the answer is we need a little bit of anything at all levels to unlock the gridlock. But as it relates to workforce, as it relates to attracting people in that specific demographic, do you have a sense of how much of this ADA-supported construction would ideally be rental versus how much of it would be units that would be desirable because it would be an ownership option for the people in this demographic?
So with permission to speak in generalities, we have a high rental population. I think it's roughly, over 40%. And people who are just coming to the state or people in the low middle bracket tend to rent more while they save up the money to buy. This bill is targeting on rental, but there would be, I think, a very healthy appetite for a similar product around ownership. We see a lot of sweat equity projects that attract a lot of folks who could otherwise not afford to buy, and they really do want to buy and own. So I think this model, if it works for rental properties, could easily be adapted for ownership properties as well.
A follow-up. Just briefly, and this might be to the bill sponsor, but could you clarify the comment that this bill is directed at rental property? As I quickly read the language, it seems like this bill provides an indeterminate type of housing that could be rental, could be condos, could be a rent-to-own, could be many things. But could you clarify, I'm sorry, either through the bill sponsor, Chair, to clarify that comment about this is a bill aimed at rental property or not?
Representative Story.
Through the chair, thank you, Rep. Holland, for that question. I think Ada would be a good person to talk to about that. We've got the deputy director online and talking with him. Earlier, I know rental housing complexes, it's easy to know the amount of income that Ada's going to be getting each month for the investment with condos, and is someone going to buy them or not? Will they be open? I think it has to do with the guarantee and the worthiness of their project. But so the focus is on rental. And then a lot of our workforce is able to rent and not afford ownership. But anyway, I would like to defer to the deputy director for any comments he would like to make on that.
Thank you. We will go to Mr. Brifschinski. But Ms. Brown, you're hopefully still available because I know Representative Ruffridge had a question for you as well. Mr. Brifschinski, are you? Do you need that question repeated?
For the record, Brandon Brifschinski, deputy director for Ada. Madam Chair, no, I think I understand the question around whether Ada would finance houses for like residential, like ownership, single family homes or condos for purchase versus financing a commercial rental, like a multi-unit project. And I think that the committee has addressed this, you know, in your conversation. The answer is we would finance a rental project, rental development. That is something that we can model out. We can cash flow based upon occupancy. So that way we know that we would get repaid, whereas financing like a single family home or housing development, that it's unknown. It's less certain for when those houses would sell, and what is our, like in terms of our collateral. So the answer is we would finance a rental unit because that is something that we can model out, that we can predict, we can ensure that we'll get repaid for our investment.
So although the bill's not specific that way, the economic model leads more to rentals than purchasing.
Correct, Madam Chair. And I would defer to HSC in terms of programs and policies around the financing of single-family home ownership.
Would you like to go there?
Thank you, Chair. I think at the moment the comment I'd like to make is just that as a policy opportunity for us, I'd like to be pursuing this from the standpoint of what does the market need versus what does a particular agency want to do. I don't mean to be negative or blunt about it, but I appreciate the clarification for the moment that the intent behind this was for rental property that wasn't clear in the bill. Perhaps we'll want to clear that up at some point, but I'm also a little more interested in continuing the discussion and the access that we have to the subject matter experts and programs to explore a little bit more what does the workforce market really need, and is there an opportunity for us to tailor this in a way that is specifically doing what our communities, our employers say is needed for workforce housing. If that turns out to be rental, then let's clarify that's what we're doing. If it turns out that there's a broader need, then I'm interested in exploring it. So this conversation's been helpful just to kind of clarify what we're working on and what's happening. So.
And it could be that we're looking at that gap in the rental rather than solving all of the problems, but I think maybe Representative Story has got more clarification on that.
Thank you to the chair. And I spoke really limiting there too. I think the hope with this bill is that Ada certainly has a goal of wanting our economy to thrive here, and they're set up to help help development, and we've gotten to the point where workforce housing is really an impediment to that. It's a huge impediment. And so this bill, I hope, and just listening to our invited testimony, that AIDA is going to be, you know, looking at some of these investments and partnerships that was talked about, and getting creative, opening up some doors. So I see it as more than rental, but I know in just talking with AIDA, about five dwelling units or more, that they see it as rental as more of a guarantee on their income. But I think, obviously, as we've talked about before, AIDA does have the power right now to develop workforce housing. This just puts it into statute, and the idea is that we're really making a statement to AIDA that we really want AIDA to move in this direction and be looking at all that this bill says that AIDA can do in many different ways. So I appreciate your comment, and I think there should be lots of opportunities. And I see AIDA as a willing organization. I appreciate their support of this bill, and I thank you for your comments.
Since we do have Stacey Barnes online with HFC, Ms. Barnes, would you be able to illuminate us a little bit on the other piece of the puzzle that Representative Holland is alluding to, and that would be programs that AHFC has for this sort of like gap housing between just the next level above affordable housing and the programs that you have to provide that versus the ability to finance larger like rental projects.
Stacey. Madam Chair, this is Stacey Barnes, Director of Governmental Relations and Public Affairs for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Thank you. Would you like me to repeat the question?
Yes, if you would, please, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we're getting into the discussion about this next level of housing above affordable housing for folks that are, you know, in the workforce, and we're discussing that the bill with AIDA addresses more potentially larger rental properties, and we're also discussing the needs of ownership of that level of housing. Could you address the robustness of programs at AHFC to address home loans for people to buy housing in that on that level?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, this is Stacey Barnes, and AHFC's mission is to provide Alaskans with access to safe, quality, and affordable housing. And through that mission, we are able to provide housing through our public housing programs. We operate in 16 communities across the state, utilizing federal HUD funds for those programs. We also are the state's housing finance authority, or excuse me, housing finance agency. And in that regard, we are able to provide home loans to Alaskans with 1 to 4 units based on the creditworthiness of those borrowers and the ability to go to market and provide Alaskans with those loans, working in partnership with banks and credit unions across the state. Additionally, we do provide multifamily financing as well for rental properties. And in the material that I provided to the committee last week, you saw the number of loans that AHFC has financed last fiscal year and also so far this fiscal year, and the number of loans that are in our multifamily portfolio. One important distinction is that AHFC does not provide construction lending, which I think is what this bill was designed to focus on.
Thank you. I think that's helpful in identifying some of those gaps. Representative Holland, did you have a follow-up on that?
I did. Thank you. I think, clarify the area of interest that I have, and Ms. Mars, I think you've touched on a couple pieces of this, but I'm looking specifically at the question of workforce housing, not necessarily above the rental workforce focus, but for those people that are looking to be able to own, I'm thinking about condo units that might have, you know, 10 or 20 units in a condo development project that provides workforce affordable housing, but in a multi-unit type project. Mm-hmm. And I know throughout Anchorage, we have many areas that were developed that way. I'm thinking, you know, off the top of my head of Fox Ridge over on, I think, C Street, that I don't know the number of units. It could be 100 units in there that were built, I think, in the 80s that were a very important middle tier of workforce housing, allowed people to move into that. I'm thinking of my son who, you know, is stuck right now in a rental unit with a professional salary, trying to find that next step up there in units and finding that what's available isn't there. And I'm seeing this gap in what we've discussed so far. It sounds like with HFC, if I understood correctly, that there's home loan programs for 1 to 4 units, but only if you go above that, it's only for rental units. I'm seeing that the interest with ADA is with doing rental units because of cash flow. It sounds like there's this gap of workforce housing for those folks that might want to and might be able to move that next little step up into owning their own house, but it might still be in the same income range that we're attributing to the rental market. So I guess back to Ms. Barnes, maybe you could clarify, are there some programs with AHFC that help with that multi-unit ownership type of housing development? Or, you know, is that or isn't that a gap from your perspective in the type of housing and the need for housing?
Through the chair, Representative Holland, in the example of your son who may be seeking a condo, what I would encourage any Alaskan who's interested in homeownership to do is to take our free homebuyer education class. And then we have many single-family loan programs that might be appropriate for his circumstances. As an example, if he's a first-time home buyer, we have a loan program for him. If he may be a veteran, we have a program for him. And for Alaskans also who are seeking perhaps their second or their third home that they've owned, AHSD could provide support in that regard. As to the multifamily loans, yes, we are able to finance condos, and in fact, we have a renovation program for those as well in the example of the Fox Ridge development that you were referring to. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Through the chair, in part it does, but I think it also just seems to confirm to me that there's a gap in the construction, because in this case, I wasn't bringing up the need to find a loan. I'm looking at, are we able to invest in the projects that would create these available units to do that? So I think I've got a little better understanding of the options in there, and I'm just getting a growing understanding of this issue. I don't mean to derail us too far on ownership, but I know for workforce, and particularly as we're trying to encourage career-oriented people to move to Alaska or Alaskans to stay in Alaska, ownership is an important step. And I think that's a piece of this workforce housing issue I'd like to understand as we continue to look at new tools. Thank you.
So we do have a follow-up from Representative Hall before we get back to Ms. Brown and Representative Ruffridge. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I think it'll be brief. Thank you, Ms. Barnes, for being here. My question has to do with the 15 multifamily loans that AHC offered in FY24 and in the current fiscal year, 12 multifamily loans. How many total units does that include?
Madam Chair, I don't have, through the Chair, Representative Hall, the total number of units over the last 2 years, I don't have that data in front of me right now, but I'd be happy to get back to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ruffridge. The conversation's progressed quite a bit since you told me you had a question, so.
Yeah.
Apologies.
I think I had a question for a number of folks. The first one was for the testifier from Housing Alaskans. In their letter that they sent on April 17th, they had discussed that they had made investments into projects resulting in 122 new housing units in a variety of communities. And I was wondering just sort of some basic information on those projects, maybe just sort of general information, as in what was an average cost per square foot of those housing projects, in the, especially ones that were done in the last 2 years, if they had any information on that.
Ms. Brown?
Thank you, Madam. Through the chair, thank you for the question. The way Housing Alaskans works is a housing trust that blends public and private dollars. And what we found, we had pretty much a one-to-one match. We had a state investment of $1 million, and then we matched it with about $900,000 of private funds. And what we found across the state were dozens and dozens of projects that were in the works and had already almost complete capital stacks, because and they had taken anywhere from 5 to 2 years to develop all those funding sources. It's very complex, and some of them had as many as 40 funding sources. But because prices were constantly rising, they could never get a full capital stack, and they were stalled. And a lot of them had a lot of public money in there, but that money wasn't being put to use because they couldn't ever get enough money to get going on the project. So we decided to invest our first dollars into these projects that were stalled and languishing, and some were at risk of losing some of their public dollars because they hadn't built fast enough. And we ended up, through two grant cycles, accelerating 122 units to come online. And that's the point that I was mentioning earlier, is we have lots of funding programs. I'm not saying we have enough money for housing, but we have lots of programs. But they are all so siloed that everybody gets bits and pieces, and too many folks do not get all they need. And by, you know, having an entity like ADA or AHSC doing more of that coordination would get a lot of projects across the finish line without a major new investment. So most of the grants we gave were under $150,000, but it was enough to take them out of stall and into completion.
Thank you. Representative Ruffridge?
I feel like I keep asking a simple question and getting not the answer, but maybe folks will follow up with me on cost per square foot. I feel like a lot of folks on the line are involved in building things, and I'm just trying to get a simple understanding of what it costs to build something currently. I guess my follow-up question on this particular issue is, what of the 122 new housing units in these communities, I assume that those were rentals. Maybe they aren't, but what was the cost on average to rent one of these housing units, or what was the cost to purchase one once they were completed?
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Please do.
Okay. These are a mix of rental and ownership, and I can get you data. I don't have it off the top of my head of what the rental prices are per unit. The home ownership ones involve sweat equity, so the owners, the prospective owners, are building. On your question of square, what it costs to build, in the study we did, and this was a couple years ago, so this it's much higher now, but in Anchorage, it was running about $250 per square foot. In Bethel, it was about $350 per square foot. Lower 48 is more like $130 per square foot. And I can get you more updated information, but that's what we had as of a couple of years ago.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. And then I guess my second question would be for the individual from AHFC, sort of that same question about have they noticed have any information on what the cost per square foot is to build in their program in the last year or two.
Ms. Barnes?
Yes, through the chair, Stacey Barnes again. Cost per square footage is something that we'd be happy to get back to the committee on, looking at our portfolio and sharing that information with you. I just don't have the data at my fingertips.
Okay, and so just a comment, if I may, and I think appreciate the bill sponsor for bringing this forward. I think it's been a really valuable conversation. Do we have other invited testifiers? Or okay, I tend to agree with Representative Holland's line of questioning, sort of asking, is this sort of pointing in the right direction? I think one of the things that I struggle with currently, I think $250 per square foot is on the low end of the spectrum currently. And so even if we throw ADA at this problem, we could throw AHFC at the problem. I actually think the folks from Housing Alaskans really kind of hit the nail on the head when they say that this almost has to be a philanthropic operation where you are literally giving money to people in order to make it be affordable. ADA is not going to do that. AHFC isn't going to do that. If you have a cost per square foot of $250, and that's the low end of the spectrum, very low end, what you're going to have is a 1,000-square-foot apartment, which is not a large place to occupy, costs $250,000 to build. I think this is the thing we got to point at here when we're talking about this as the committee, which is, What is happening currently? What are the factors that are causing those things to be so expensive? So if you're a contractor, of course, the thing that you're going to go and build is the thing that with the people that have the dollars to pay you to do the work. A $250,000, 1,000-square-foot apartment, that is not – you got to rent that for a lot of dollars. And it becomes unaffordable. And so then you're stuck either buying old things and trying to renovate it slightly, which does not increase your housing stock, or waiting for prices to fall, or hoping that someone is philanthropic with $2 million and helps you out. So I guess maybe there is a question in there to the bill sponsor, which is how do we overcome the fact that we can throw ADA at this, AHFC at this, all the other things, but at the end of the day, it's just really expensive to build anything right now. Are you hoping that ADA, the word that we've said is gets creative? By gets creative, is this a zero interest loan? Is it giving money away? I don't know how we get there to make it be affordable.
Add to that question, because along the same lines, and I don't want to
please do.
I don't want to detract from the question, but I made a note to myself. It was the representative from Fairbanks who sits next to me on the floor last year who said, "Well, we just got to make it more affordable." Would the bill seems to specify building things, but is there a universe in which we make shipping more affordable or something like that? So I think I'm thinking in the same direction, and I just wanted to throw that into the question.
It seems like that's getting into maybe a little bit more committee and other work rather than necessarily this bill itself. But
yeah, and I think, again, to follow up, I apologize through the chair to keep talking, but we're touching on a real problem, but I think that the solution in the underlying bill might not be the solution that we're looking for, which granted, is a great way to start the conversation, and I appreciate that. But we can certainly pass this bill down the process, and we can all do a rah-rah moment. But I think at the end of the day, I'm not certain what problem that it solves without asking that question, which is, are there steps along the way? If the cost to build in Idaho is $130 per square foot, what's the difference between Idaho and here? Well, it's the cost of getting the goods here, and other factors. So I think we should start asking about what goes into $250 per square foot.
And labor needs to pay for high housing costs, and we're kind of chicken and egging some of it. But yeah, no, there are some deeper questions that might be a little bit more than Representative Story has bit off with the bill. But Representative Story, do you have some contribution to the conversation about this?
Thank you through the chair, and thank you for all the comments and really discussion today, because as you know, we're sitting here because shipping costs are high, labor, people can't find places to live. This is really a key problem. I don't know about you guys, but in my communities, one of the number one issues, and I know Senator Murkowski said the number one issue she sees, the number one priority in Alaska should be for housing. It is really closing us off. And so all the things that you're talking about, Rep. Ruffridge, we definitely need to be tackling, and I know some people in the private industry are trying to tackle about how, you know, ask questions, how can we get shipping costs down, things like that. But and yeah, we need to be asking ourselves those questions too. What can we be doing? I mean, I think about our ferry system and how we move goods around in our ferry system, and we is that affordable? And but I think what I wanted to bring it back to the bill here, and again, this bill, of course, is not a silver bullet at all, but it's another tool that we can have, and we definitely need Ada to get creative. And Ada wants, it's our state corporation to help drive economic development, and we know a hindrance to that is housing and making it work, and so we need to work. And again, when I was talking earlier, how can Ada make developers aware of more what they're willing to do and to offer and go out and advertise, because we have not had interest from developers to take some things on. What can we be doing? And I think we need to be looking at, and how can we incentivize? And I think Ada is an organization who could really show some leadership in this area, and we need them to show leadership.
Thank you. Representative Prox.
I want to get back, I guess, to the crux of the bill, is giving Ada some more authority rather than AHFC. And we have Ada and AHFC on the line. Have you been talking to each other about this proposal, and do you agree that this is something that Ada should be doing rather than AHFC?
Let's start with Mr. Brifschinski.
For the record, Brandon Brifschinski, Deputy Director, Ada. Through the chair, Representative Prox, we've had limited communications with AHFC just in the context of this bill, but as far as, like, if this is something Ada should be doing, I mean, I've gone on record, I've mentioned how Ada currently has the ability to finance multi-unit housing projects, And for the record, too, I mean, we don't have any pending applications from any developers before us right now. I think, you know, this has been a good conversation around what are some of the other policies or factors that might be limiting the demand for housing financing. If we were to have an application before us from somebody seeking our financing, we would consider it and run it through our process of, our due diligence process, just like we would any other type of loan application. But as of date, we do not have any. That said, I have also mentioned we've had conversations with some municipalities around what it would look like for some Ada financing of multi-unit housing, for the workforce. And, those conversations are ongoing. So does that answer your question, Representative Prox?
Almost. We could hear from AHFC, same question. Have you been talking with Ada, and do you agree that the intent of this bill to give, now it almost seems that Ada is focusing on the developer part of this, and AHFC is focusing on the consumer part of this. So that might make more sense. But it seems like either agency could do this right now without this bill. And I'm not sure just exactly what we're accomplishing, and I'm concerned that we're spreading ADA too thin, perhaps. And I'm just wanting to make sure that we're not doing – I don't think we're going to make a lot of difference. I hope we're not going backwards and creating more confusion in the market. So have you been talking together – AHFC, have you been talking together with ADA?
Ms. Barnes?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Prox. Again, for the record, this is Stacey Barnes. And about a year ago, Senator Dunbar had approached us with the recognition that he had that housing is constrained in communities statewide and felt that there was an opportunity for ADA to participate in the financing of the construction aspect of new development statewide. AHSC is happy to answer questions and provide technical information on the bill. And in fact, AHSC has worked with ADA previously on projects that have come forward where ADA has been looked at as a developer and AHSC can provide the long-term financing for the project.
Okay. And just in the Fairbanks North Pole area. AHFC, I believe, completed a fairly large apartment building complex, South Fairbanks. Do you remember that? Within the last year or two.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I do. And what you're referring to, if you don't mind, Madam Chair, is the subsidiary corporation that AHSC has. It's the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing, and we have completed 58 units of new housing construction, both for families and seniors at that location.
And when I visited those, it appeared to me that they were pretty much exactly what we're talking about in this bill, the need for workforce housing. And is your subsidiary then owning that project, or is that somebody else in the private sector ends up owning the project?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, that is owned by the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing.
Okay. And then for ADA, there was a project proposed out in North Pole. I believe they were building, that was residential, quite a few houses. It didn't quite pan out. I don't know. Could we explain that? Because there was another apartment building project that was, the developer was an individual. One worked out, the other didn't. And then there was another subdivision project out there that, for whatever reason, didn't pan out. Frankly, I don't understand it. But does ADA focus on helping developers? Is that maybe the distinction and why this should be an ADA rather than AHFC?
So this is for Mr. Brzezinski?
For Mr. Brzezinski, yes.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, for the record, Brandon Brzezinski, Deputy Director, ADA. I believe what you're referring to, Representative, is like the military housing efforts, right, up there in North Pole to accommodate the F-35s.
Yep.
To answer that question fully as to like what occurred or what had happened, I wasn't currently at ADA at the time. I was in my previous employment and worked for the governor's office. Mm-hmm. When those conversations were underway, and I mean, from what I understand, you know, there were competing or different views, I guess, at the time for what development should go forward. I know ADA was involved in some of those conversations. I think from the context of like help for the housing development. But as far as what happened or why those discussions broke down, I'd have to follow back up with you and get back to you and to answer it fully.
That would probably be worthwhile because we don't have the time today.
Thank you.
Right. And also for the Representative Proximino, we have had conversations with the Fairbanks North Star Borough. I'm going to say the previous mayor, Mayor Ward, and talking with them at the time, it was almost as if there wasn't the need.
Yep.
Is what we were hearing, but then I hear from others that there is a need, so it's unclear. But if there were a project to develop housing out there, and it would happily engage in that conversation.
Okay. Thank you.
So before we go to Representative Story and Representative Holland, I just wanted to give a quick time check. We only have a few minutes left. And we do have public testimony on the list for today, although that should go quick since I haven't got anybody online. So Representative Story, did you want to address that?
Well, I just, through the chair to the committee, I just wanted to make a couple comments. And one of them is Ada has not done any housing development since the 1980s. I think it needs to have an upstart in making people aware about this and that, yes, Ada is very much interested in doing this. So I think that might have something to do with the lack of applications. I also think that this is a complex problem, our housing problem, and we're going to have to target it by many different areas if we want to move the dial on this. And I would like to say that I think Ada and AHFC are complementary to each other and try and work together well. And in my dealings and talking with both of them, I think they've been supportive of each other's efforts, and I appreciate them being online today.
Thank you, Representative Holland.
Great, thank you. Just a brief comment and a question, or suggestion, I'm sorry. One is, I think we've heard today from a lot of the folks that are supplying the resources to do the projects, and it's just compelling to me at this point that we've not heard much from the actual developers that would build anything. So my suggestion is, I would find it really helpful if in a follow-up hearing we could potentially hear from some of the folks that are building these projects that could tell us about their experience and the market conditions for being able to do a project. I would be particularly interested in some of the housing development corporations. CITC, I think, has done some really good projects that I've seen around Anchorage, both individual houses, the little bird houses that they did, as well as large multifamily projects. I'd really like to understand what they're running into in terms of the, not necessarily their unique funding stack, but what are they running into in terms of the challenge of building the kind of units that we're looking for. And potentially also hearing from a couple of the businesses that have been involved in providing housing solutions. I know in Seward, there's an effort to provide workforce housing that's been done by some of the tourism operators. So I think if we could have potentially a couple different prongs of the pull side of this discussion as opposed to the agency push side of this, it might help us see a better picture of both the challenge but also the alignment of how we could help support ADA as being another piece of the solution. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll need to wrap up our conversation for today there. And we will go through the process of public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Don't see anyone in the room here for public testimony, as we have staff and our invited testimony. And online, seeing and hearing none, I will now close public testimony. One of the shortest ever. Thank you all for this really good discussion today, not just about the bill, but also about some larger issues. Thank you, Representative Story, and your staff for the discussion today as well. Since I think we've got more discussion to have, not setting an amendment deadline for the bill at this point. We'll see how that discussion goes and discuss that further. If we come up with one before our next meeting, we'll send that out by email. So for today, we will now set House Bill 184 aside. And that will conclude our business for today. We do not have any agenda items for our meeting on May 1st, so Thursday's meeting will be canceled, so everyone can enjoy their mornings a little bit more this Thursday. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned. It is 9:59 a.m.